David has too, who is an expert in both quantum foundations and quantum information, with a string of important results in both of those fields. He did his PhD with Yavke Aronov in Tel Aviv. Then he had postdocs in Boston, Brussels, Cambridge, and then he got a position in Cambridge, followed by a professorship in Bristol, where he's been since 1999. He's one of our distinguished research chairs at Griffith Institute, and also I think the announcement hasn't been officially made yet, but he will be next week announced as the recipient of this year's Bell Prize, which is a big prize in quantum theory. But he was second recipient, last year's recipient was Peter. And today he's going to speak on the smallest possible thermal machine.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, it's really a pleasure to come to the Institute. And well, last week I tried to speak about foundations of quantum mechanics, so this time I will go to something that was completely different for me. I never imagined that I will ever work on thermodynamics, but you know, one thing just leads to another. And thank you. So what I'm going to talk today is about the smallest possible thermal machines and all kind of ideas of regarding to foundations of thermodynamics. Now, it all started when one of my friends, Hans Briegel, came to visit me in Bristol, and he was talking about the possibility of having quantum effects in biology. Now, this whole issue of whether or not are quantum effects in biology started long ago, in fact, in the very early days of quantum information, when people realized that entanglement can have all these strong computational advantages and so on. But it was dismissed. You know, some people enthusiastically said yes, definitely yes. It would explain telepathy. Never mind that it was not proven that telepathy exists in the first place. May explain consciousness, may explain free will. Okay, the other people said, no, forget it. And the reason being that, you know, it is so difficult to maintain quantum coherence that people have to work very hard in the labs just to do almost anything. So to imagine that inside a biological system that is warm and wet, extraordinarily noisy, it is impossible to have anything like that. However, we came to realize that, as a matter of fact, all the intuitions that people had in order to dismiss the existence of quantum effects in biology was based on false premises. That is, most people were thinking of equilibrium processes. But but biological systems are in fact open, driven systems very far from thermal equilibrium. You know, we eat, we get an influx of free energy in our body, we do all kind of things. I don't want to get to thermal equilibrium anytime soon. Right, so then we were thinking, what can these systems do? So one thing that we know is that we can have error correction. And in fact, if you think, a lot of the things that our bodies do is error correction. When an animal dies, it immediately starts decomposing in a matter of hours. That means that there are processes that try to decompose it, that try to inflict errors on the system. And most of the free energy is used in order to try to repair this. So all the time that life goes on, it is a continuous system of error correcting. Well, that is done at classical level. The question is whether it can be done at quantum level. Now, amongst many others, we had all kind of ideas, you know, we just played with the ideas, and thinking, could I imagine a way in which a biological system might do error correction? And one possibility was perhaps some parts of the biological system can act as refrigerators. This would be one of the ways in which error correction. Come, you are allowed. No matter. Look, as long as the room is not at equilibrium, I'm happy. Yeah. So one of the ways in which we can stabilize quantum effects is if we cool down systems. So then we ask, could biological systems act as refrigerators? And in fact, we know that we can, because we survived in Spain at 50-something, and we still our body temperature is 37. So obviously we can act as refrigerators as a big system. Most probably our brain and our liver are hotter than other parts of the body. But the question is whether there could be refrigerators at much smaller level. So for example, could biological molecules act as refrigerators? If they could, then they could stabilize perhaps some quantum effects. All right, so we reached that idea. And then, of course, I realize I have not a clue what a biological molecule is or how it could work as a refrigerator. So what do you do then? Well, one way to do is you just go to the internet or go to the library and start reading about biological molecules. That's what a serious person should do. And refrigerators, because I didn't know about refrigerators either. Yes. Well, but there are other things to do. So one thing, just forget about the problem. So it was nice, a very interesting motivation. But then I said, look, rather than doing that, let me go to things that I know. And what do I know? Well, I know about qubits. So then forget about complicated. Yes, please.
I mean, even though we are far from equilibrium systems, we are at a finite temperature, and certainly the information storage in biological molecules like DNA and RNA can be extracted from fossils thousands of years later, which we certainly need.
Yes.
So then the preservation of biological information is not due to...
Yes, but I was not talking about... biology is not only the information. So it's metabolism going on. So the fact that I live at this moment is not equivalent with the fact that my information could be read and stored on a piece of paper as, my DNA.
No, I'm very sympathetic to you, but
yes.
It's not the case that error correction is keeping DNA stable.
Oh, no, it's not keeping the DNA, it's keeping everything stable. Your body is attacked by bacteria coming into it.
No, sure. But biological molecules like DNA are stable at finite temperature, period.
We have many different things that are stable at many different scales. So there are processes that are maintained. Their stability is far more robust. It's a question of energy gaps, like in the DNA. There are other systems that have to be maintained on a more regular basis. It's a complicated thing. And by the way, error correction occurs in DNA while replicating.
Right.
Yes. So there are, all these were ideas that we were just playing, at a coffee and discussing it, taking them seriously, as a matter of fact. But, okay, but that would be another talk. This was just the way in which I arrived at the question. So then I said, look, since I don't know anything about biology, let me forget about it. But the question is, can I now think of a smaller refrigerator? And I know about two-level systems, qubits. So then let me ask, how can I construct a very, very small refrigerator? Small meaning a few qubits or something like that. Well, the moment you already get to such a question, then you say, okay, let me let me get more fundamental than that. Instead of asking, can I build something out of a few qubits, let me ask, what is the smallest possible? See, it appears that it's more of a constraint. You much easier can build one just small than the one that is the smallest possible. As a matter of fact, there are different ways in which you reach simplicity. And sometimes asking about the most fundamental may get rid of all kind of details and may allow you to make progress. So let me get a little bit more technical here. When I think of a small one, I want it to be self-contained, because obviously everyone who works in quantum optics knows that they can cool an atom. There's laser cooling, they shine lasers, they do all kind of things, they do that for a living. But then, I cannot claim that that is a small refrigerator, because that's an atom there, but you also have the big laser here, and you have to take into account all the degrees of freedom. So that's why I wanted something that is self-contained. So one thing that I will not allow is no external source of work. Now, there is something else, mostly for people working in information. I will not allow any predetermined unitary transformations. You know, a Hamiltonian induces a unitary transformation, but the basic object is the Hamiltonian. In order to ensure that a Hamiltonian will produce a desired unitary transformation, you need a control mechanism. You need to turn it on, to turn it off in time. You make sure that there are no other interactions that will disturb it. So I want just to start really from Schrödinger equation, couple a Hamiltonian, let it go. What else, however? No thermal machine can work if you don't have an influx of free energy. So what I will allow my refrigerator to be in contact with two thermal baths, okay, which supply free energy, but in, you know, in a disorganized, not in a coherent form. Okay, so what are the sort of questions we will discuss? Well, it's how to construct them, what is the minimal size, how well do they work, is there a complementarity between size and efficiency, and things like this. Right, so let me start. First of all, I had no idea what a refrigerator is. I don't know how Neil spotted this. I never told him, probably just looked at me. As a matter of, never mind. This is the only thing I knew, really how it works. And how it works is like this. You have here a pedal wheel, and you have a box with gas, and you would like to extract work out of it. And molecules come and hit the wheel from the left, hit the wheel from the right, and the wheel goes and fluctuates. So you can't really do anything with it, because it moves to left, it moves to the right. You would like it to go only in one direction. What happens? I had so many computer problems today, starting down. Okay, here is how it works. So what you do, you would like to put here this wheel with teeth on it and with a little stick and a spring there. So this is a ratchet and pull arrangement. So what happens is that the wheel cannot turn anti-clockwise, it can only go clockwise by pushing up the little stick, and that's it. So now the movement, it is in one direction, and you are very happy. Not for a long time. Because then realize that actually there is a problem. And the problem is that whenever the wheel moves, it pushes the little stick up, and then it falls back, you know, pushed by the string. But it starts jumping. Up and down, up and down. And as a certain moment, it will jump so much that the wheel can move left and right and left and right. Bless you. Now, I want to prevent that. I want not to jump. So what I should do, I should put here another box with gas that is colder than that one. And, you know, these are thermal fluctuations. So I want them to be dissipated into the gas. So it gets cooled down, and then it just remains at the lower position and acts as a constraint on the wheel. So what happens is that then the wheel moves in one way. I can attach here a weight that will be lifted by it. And in the process, a weight will come up. Energy will be taken from those molecules, but some energy will be dumped for cooling here. So the question was, can I do something similar? I need to find a small system. I need to find a constraint that forces it to go only in one way, and to implement that with very, very simple systems. Okay. So here is the smallest possible refrigerator. I will build it up in stages. Here it is a two-level system, like, say, a spin in a magnetic field or two levels of an atom and so on. And it is surrounded by a thermal bath, a temperature T1. So then you know what it happens. It spends some longer time in the ground state, sometimes is excited, spends some time there, comes back, and so on. So roughly the population is larger on the ground state than on the top state. I want to cool. It means I want to make it more probable that it will be in the ground state than not. So here's a way of doing it. You put next to it, in the same thermal bath, another two-level system. And now you couple an interaction between them. And here is the interaction. It's an interaction that allows this one to go down in energy and pass the energy to the other one. So this is in addition to the interaction with the environment. There is now another way, another channel by which my qubit can lose energy. It loses energy by passing it to the other one. So now it spends more time on the lower level. Well, the bad news is that the other transition is possible, that once this is on the ground and the other one is excited, this one can disexcite and push this one back up. Now, it is a fundamental thing that all our Hamiltonians have equal coupling constant for both transitions. If that wouldn't be the case, then we would not discuss about thermodynamics in the first place. So this transition, if I'm not careful enough, it's equally likely as the other transition. But thinking of Feynman's ratchet, I see that there is a constraint here. In order for this red transition to occur, it must be the case that the qubit that I want to cool is on the ground state and the other one is on the excited state. So if I will remove this one from the excited state, say by hand, then it will not push my qubit of interest up in energy. Now, I don't want to do that by hand because I just said that I want to account for all degrees of freedom. But one way of doing it is I will put this at a temperature T2 that is smaller than T1. So then its own environment will be more likely to drag it down. Now, because it is down, this red transition does not occur. So essentially, I'm cooling this one. Okay? And it works. It really works. And it is also trivial, because what happens now is that I have here something that is colder than this, that I put them in thermal contact, and it cools it. You know, you put a piece of ice in your glass, it's cold, fine, useful, but not very interesting scientifically. So what you do? Now that you got the idea, you can build something more interesting. And here it is. This is the qubit of interest, which is a temperature T1. I take two other qubits, not only one, but two. One that has a spacing E2, the other one has a spacing E3, and I want that E2 should be equal with E1 and E3. And now I couple a triple transition. A transition in which the external ones go down in energy by pushing the middle one up, and the other way around. Okay? So, again, the red transition is, as far as the Hamiltonian concern, equally strong as the green one. But what I would like to do now, you see, there are many ways, because it's coupled. In order for the red one to occur, I need ground, excited, ground. So I can either remove this one from the excited by lowering T1, or in fact I can remove this one from the ground state by increasing T2. So now, because this is removed by the environment and put up there, it's no longer here, the constraint is not obeyed, and the red transition does not occur. So what I did now, I have T1, T1, T2 that is larger, and by this I succeed to drag this one lower down. So if you want to think of your refrigerator at home, somehow this one, E2, that gets pushed up is like the spiral on the back of your refrigerator. And then it will dissipate, will get a bit hotter because it is pushed up all the time, more than it will be done by the environment. And then it will dissipate energy in its environment. This one is more or less the engine, is the thing that pushes things down. So in fact, the engine is a combination between this hot and the cold bath. And they act to cool my qubit. Okay? That's all. So my refrigerator, this is the object that gets cooled, and my refrigerator essentially is made out of two qubits that are put in contact with two thermal baths, T1 and T2. You can think more generally. Pick three qubits which, with this sort of relation between the energy levels, and the transitions are between excited, ground, excited, to ground, excited, ground. And you would like this forward transition, in which the qubit of interest goes from excited to ground, to be preferred to this one. For that to happen, I need that the initial population being here should be larger than the population being down there. Because then this transition will be preferred to that transition. So all you need, the general thing, is that the population being here and there, which is essentially the Boltzmannian of being the first one and the third one excited, I consider the lower energy zero, that is just the reference. This one should be larger than the population of this one being excited. And that is all I need for my refrigerator to work. Okay. So, as you see, I started in Feynman's case to discuss about an engine that produces work, but then I went to refrigerators. And the refrigerators are always more complicated thing and more, and not so usual, although you have them at home, but. So why did I think of a refrigerator in the first instance? You see, there is a difference between heat and work. That heat is when you pass energy in a sort of disordered way, while work is a very organized way in which you put energy. But when you come to very small systems, what is ordered and what is disordered, well, it's not very clear. So that's why I first said, let me forget about work. Let me do the refrigerator where I know exactly what I'm talking about. And then I will go and talk about work. By the way, just to impress you, make sure that you don't think it's too simple. You see, I didn't present you the whole gory mathematics there. There I presented you only the principle of functioning. Now you really want to see that it works. Then you need to put the Hamiltonian, you need to put some master equation that tells you how the qubits get thermalized and how they dissipate the energy, and you have to solve that whole thing. And then when you do, you find not only the fact that it works like a refrigerator, but you find what the actual temperatures are, you find what the rate of passing the energy is, and so on. But I just wanted to present you the basic ideas, not to go through the details. But coming back to work, yeah, that is what I wanted to avoid. I wanted to avoid having to define what work is in the first place at molecular level. The other thing is that I didn't go to read what other people think about it, because I found with hindsight that there are very many ideas of how to define work. I would have never got out of it. But I took a very pragmatic view. I thought back of what does my engine do? And if I succeed to lift a weight just by using 2 qubits, then that is work enough for me. Okay? So here is the thing. I just want to be able to lift, create a machine that will just lift a weight, and that is fine. So just go to this idea. Now, how do I model the weight? Well, it's very simple. This is like a weight, you know, I increase it, just raising, say, a weight that I raise on a staircase, you know. And then it has different energy levels, and this is what I want. I want to have a system that I just push them up, okay? And the machine that will succeed doing this, being coupled to 2 thermal baths, would be a heat engine. So how do I do it? Well, again, all I have to do is to take 2 qubits. That's all. I was quite surprised when I realized that this is all I need. And again, I want to have a triple connection. So first of all, I want that the energy difference between 2 levels here plus E3 to be equal to E2. And now I want to put a transition in which when this one goes down, will excite here and will excite this one. Why can't I just excite one of them? Because then I have really no way to continuously push. I need to be able to implement a constraint somewhere. And that constraint will be essentially implemented there. All I need to make this transition in which the middle one disexcites and pushes the 2 sideways up. I want to make it more likely than the other one in which these 2 go down and push the middle one up. So I want, since this one is not coupled to a thermal bath, you know, you don't put your weight in a thermal bath. You can do that, but then you will just change a little bit the equation. So I want the population here to be larger than the population there. That's all I want. And the claim is that if you now write your master equations and you do everything, you find that this system, what it does, it takes the weight and just continuously pumps energy into it. Right. Okay. Now we come to more interesting things. Once you are able to build these things, now you may start asking more intricate questions. So, for example, what is the efficiency? So we know that in classical physics, if I have a machine that works between 2 temperatures and lifts a weight, it is not possible to arrange that the entire heat taken from the hot bath will be transformed into work. But some of it has to be dissipated. And we saw that in the example of Feynman's machine, that I need to cool the ratchet and pole system, otherwise it will not work. And Already a couple of hundred years ago, Sadi Carnot just showed that there is maximal efficiency, where I define the efficiency as the ratio between the work and the heat extracted from the hot bath. And they cannot be equal to one, but it is subunitary. And how much smaller it is depends on the ratio of the temperature of the cold bath and the temperature of the hot bath. Okay? Now, this is an upper bound for the efficiency. The question is, can it be attained? And the question that we faced here is, can it be attained by a small system? Now, you see, to be able even classically to achieve this, you need good engineering for your system. It doesn't mean that any badly designed heat engine will work with this efficiency. It will work much worse. So now that we come to the smallest possible heat engine, even if we are very good designers, we are facing some constraints because we have a very limited number of states. Incidentally, you know, whenever I talk about the smallest one, I don't talk smallest in terms of number of atoms or weight or something, but in number of quantum states that can work. That is something that quantum mechanics gives for me, a sort of absolute way of discussing about size. Okay, so now I'm very limited. Now, I know that for a Carnot engine to work, I need to take a piston and move. That is the, you know, the textbook thing. You open, so it goes through an infinite number of states. Then you decouple, you expand more, and you come back. Here you have two limited, just a finite number of states. Okay? So now it is conceivable in the first place that that it cannot reach the maximum efficiency. In fact, you may even think more than that. You may think that there exists, and this is a very good guess, there exists a size efficiency complementarity that says whenever I have an infinite number of possible states, I can reach the maximum efficiency, but then there is a trade-off. As I start limiting the number of states, the efficiency will drop and drop and drop, and perhaps I could formulate some size efficiency complementarity relations. And that seems to be very much in the spirit of quantum mechanics. So we guessed that indeed that is, and we were looking for it. And what do you think the answer is? There is no complementarity. You can achieve maximum efficiency even with the smallest one. And as a matter of fact, the proof is so simple that I can even give it during a talk, which is something that is generally fully discouraged. So here it is how it goes. Again, remember, our constraint is that E2, the energy level splitting here, equals E1 plus E3. That is our Hertz relation. Now, you think what you would like for a machine to do if it is able to achieve the Carnot limit. Well, when it is able to achieve the Carnot limit, we know that a machine, first of all, goes slowly. And second, you should never put, say, two objects at two different temperatures in direct contact with each other. If you do that, you are dead. So I don't want, you know, in the process of working, remember, this one goes down, this one is pushed up, this one is pushed up. I don't want to push this up too much because then I will warm it up. So the qubit will no longer be at its environmental temperature, T3. I don't want this to drop too much because then it will be slightly colder than T2. It's the same thing as with your refrigerator. If the spiral behind your refrigerator is much hotter than the room, it's definitely not efficient. You want it to be almost the same temperature. So that means that essentially, I want the transition that pushes me forward to be equally likely as the transition that brings me backward. And in fact, for strict efficiency, they would be equally likely and nothing will happen. But we are talking about epsilon. So what I would like, remember, this is not connected to a heat bath. This is, and I want this transition to compare with the opposite transition. So in general, I wanted this transition to be favorable, so I wanted this population to be larger than that, but really for maximum efficiency, for the Carnot regime, I want these two to be equal. Then my system will just go back and forth, back and forth. So this is all I want, and in fact, I can simplify this just by looking at the exponent. So all I need there is E3 over T3. Okay. Now, these are energy level splittings. These are not heat transfers or anything like that. Now, the interesting thing is the following. There are two ways in which heat and work can go here. So this qubit, for example, can exchange heat with its own environment by getting in, getting out, and so on. Now, when it achieves a steady state and it just pushes the weight up, the exchange of heat back and forth to its environment just becomes zero because it will not become warmer and warmer and warmer. There is, though, another way in which it happens is that the heat that is received and, pushes it, is get transferred to the other one and transferred here. So the only thing that we are interested in the coupled oscillations, coupled transitions. And now we realize that whenever there is a coupled transition that occurs, when this one is pushed up and this one is pushed up and this one goes down, the increase of work here plus the increase of, the increase of energy here that will get dissipated occurs whenever this one goes down. So everything goes in portions. This one gets a work W whenever this one will extract from the environment a Q2 and whenever this one will dissipate a Q3. That means that the ratio between the work and the heat is exactly the same as the ratio between the energy levels. We don't know how quickly it works. Okay? In fact, at this level, it doesn't work at all. But what we know, but suppose I take an epsilon. So all I know that the ratios of work and heat are exactly the same as the ratio between the energy levels. So now all I have to do is to come to these two relations and replace the connection between the energies by the connection of work and heat. So since E3 equals E2 minus E1, I will replace it over there as E3 will be replaced by E2 minus E1, which is the same as Q2 minus W, and here I have Q2, which is exactly the Carnot limit. Right. So what is work? So I already have a machine that does work, and I have this system that is pushed up and up and up and up all the time. But what happens if the system is not infinite, if the system is limited? So instead of taking this, I will take that. So it is still the case that the transitions, these two transitions, will act together to push this guy up. So the conclusion that comes from here is that work is creating population inversion. You see, this one will be pushed up. So population inversion, that was, you know, something for laser physics and sort of marginal thing, okay, negative temperature and so on, is in fact far more profound. And my claim is that producing work is nothing else than producing population inversion. And producing population inversion is nothing else than producing work. Okay? You see it in this case, you see it even trivially, you see, I raise this, so now it's no longer on a ground state, but it is higher excited, and I just do inversions. But there is even something more than hits the eye here, and I will come back to that. But this is one of the main claims, that work is nothing else than reaching population inversion. As a matter of fact, there is something interesting here, because now this allows you to ask, so how big this inversion is, okay? How much? When you think of doing work, you think of raising this weight. So does it mean that everything will go up to the highest energy level or not? Well, the answer is not. And it depends very much on what happens. You see, it is wrong to think that any machine, even classical, just lifts something like this, if it is a thermal machine. It is essentially a biased random walk. It is more likely to come up, but sometimes it can go back. Okay? Every machine, think of Feynman's ratchet. It works and on the average turns one way, but sometimes it could turn the other way. So as it lifts something, it also spreads. But that spread is insignificant versus how much it gets lifted. But if you put a ceiling, then it gets stuck there, doesn't have place, and now it will start spreading, can only go down. So what we'll achieve an inverted Boltzmannian in the inversion. How inverted that Boltzmannian is, that depends on how efficient, of how strongly the machine pushes it. At the Carnot limit, we know that at Carnot limit the machine is extraordinarily efficient as far as the ratio of work to heat extracted is concerned, but we know that it takes a long time. So the Carnot machine was thought of being weak in the sense of taking a long time, so having zero power. But it is weak in another sense, which has nothing to do with the time. It cannot produce any inversion. It is equally likely that it goes up or down, so essentially both the ground state and the excited state will be equally populated. So it gets infinite temperature, which is, you know, the smallest inversion possible. So here I come to something even more fundamental, and is what do actually thermal machines do? Okay? And again, going to very simple examples allows you to do this. So when you look at a big thermal machine and steam and the pistons and everything moving, it is very difficult to understand what the essence of it is. Coming to the simple ones, you see them in a different way. So let me come here to say my refrigerator or whatever. You see, it is incredible that you think of the refrigerator, it is exactly like the heat engine, it's exactly the same construction. So what was the main idea? The main idea was that I need to impose this triple transition. This going up, this going down, this going up, and vice versa. So here is the transition that I'm interested in. It is ground excited ground that goes to excited ground excited. And you can stare at this for a long time, and at a certain moment you realize that there is another way in which I can look at it. And I can see that these two qubits that form the machine, they have four states, ground-ground, ground-excited, excited-ground, and excited-excited. But as far as I'm concerned, there are only these two states that play any role. So these two states, I may imagine that they constitute a qubit, okay? A virtual qubit. I will call this state an excited state because, you see, this energy is larger than that. So it will couple a ground, an excited, to an excited ground. Now, what is the energy difference between this virtual excited state and this virtual ground state? Well, it's nothing else than E2 minus E3, which is in fact E1. So I can replace this complicated view by a much simpler one. I have the external qubit to which I want to do something, and I have a virtual qubit that is exactly resonant with this one. And all it happens is that I put them in thermal contact, because when this goes up, this goes down, and the other way around. So they just are in thermal contact with each other. Now, what can I say about this virtual qubit? You see, I know what the energy splitting is, and I want to find out what is its virtual temperature. Because it has some population of the ground state and some population of the excited state, which you compute by looking, you know, what exactly these things are. So when you do that, you characterize it by virtual temperature. Okay? And what is the virtual temperature? It's pretty easy to compute, and it turns out to be this expression. I will have to tell something more about this. First of all, you see that if the two external qubits are at the same temperature, then, say, T2, then this equals the temperature T2. But in general, this can be anything. And now we can understand what is actually happening there. What is happening is that the external system is put in thermal contact and will achieve the temperature T virtual. If T virtual is smaller than all the temperatures in the game, then this is a refrigerator. If it is warmer, this is a heat pump. If it is negative, this is a heat engine. Okay? Let me draw a graph of this. So let me draw here T virtual as a function of, doesn't go, T2. Okay. While I fix the energy splittings, the E1 and E2, I keep them fixed. So I will draw some lines to help me. So this is the temperature T3, and it's T1 and T3. And I will also draw a line at 45 degrees. So on this line, T virtual equals T2. As I said before, if the two temperatures, if T2 equals T3, T virtual equals those two temperatures. And now let me draw T virtual. T virtual is something like this. Is a curve that T virtual equals T2 and equals T3 at this point. You could see that it goes, let me perhaps write them the formula on the board so that we see it. So T virtual was E2 minus E3 E2 over T2 minus E3 over T3. Right. When one of them is zero, when T2 is zero, this term is infinite, T virtual is zero. So it crosses the zero point. There is another point where the denominator is zero, and that happens, in fact, exactly for the dilation that satisfies the Carnot for the heat engines. And that is an asymptote here. So see what happens. In this region, T virtual is smaller than T3, and it is also smaller than T2. So it means that here, it is a refrigerator. T virtual is smaller than both of them. In this region, T virtual is larger than T2, and it is larger than T3. This is a heat pump. It pushes heat into something else. In this region, here, T virtual is negative, so this is a heat engine. This point is the Carnot point, which you can see it is a singularity in T virtual. That is where engines stop working. It is also interesting to continue, for example, T2, one of the thermal baths I can take to be negative, well, a bunch of inverted things, and you will see how T virtual goes, and this is more or less with periodic boundary conditions. Just comes back. Here is reaching zero temperature, so this is a very a refrigerator that can bring you down. So just with these two levels, I could in principle come as close as I want to zero. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting point. It shouldn't confuse you. As far as temperature is concerned, it is zero, but as far as population is concerned, this is a singularity, because coming from minus zero means essentially the excited state is completely populated. So this is a complete inversion. This is the strongest possible machine. You know, the weakest possible heat engine is the one that has infinite temperature, in which case almost nothing happens. There are two other things that I would like to mention. Our refrigerator at home works that I have current, I plug it in, and then it is an engine that produces work, and then it goes. That I will not call a genuine refrigerator. It uses work in order to cool. Here, this is, if I put my qubit in contact with the virtual qubit here, the virtual qubit is negative. It has a temperature smaller than T1 and T2, but it is not negative. This engine cannot produce work, but it is a pure refrigerator. It can cool without going through a work step. Similarly here, this is a genuine heat pump. It doesn't need to produce work in order to push then temperature. And by the way, whenever you have three temperatures, then you can talk, or well, whenever you have two temperatures that they just do everything, refrigerators and heat pumps are not the same. So you have the tendency when there is work to imagine that, you know, I have one temperature, but here tea hot and tea cold, and I plug work here. So if I look from the point of view of tea cold, this is a refrigerator. If I look from the point of view of tea hot, this is a heat pump, because I pump something there. But if actually, this is not the thing, but I have two heat baths, say tea hot and tea cold, that drive my whole thing, then the question is, and I have some other bath, whether I move this one into something that is hotter than these two, or whether I extract it from something that is lower than them. So when you think of the genuine things, heat pumps are completely different from refrigerators. It was just an optical illusion because we went through work that we thought that they are the same thing. So that is more or less what heat engines do. They come by coupling a thing to a virtual qubit. Where is that virtual qubit coming from? Well, that's more interesting. Whenever you take two heat baths, you can look at heat bath number one, okay? And you look at all energy levels there, and the population is in the rate, the Boltzmannian ratio for T1. Take the other one, all levels are in according to a Boltzmannian at T2. But now you may think of an energy eigenstate, which is of the combined system. And you have to look at a combined system, because it's the combined system that will activate our heat engine. And now the combined system, you can look at two levels and two levels, so you can look at virtual qubits. So whenever you have two things that are purely Boltzmannian but at different temperatures, inside they have virtual qubits at all possible temperatures. How do I know that? Because I can extract whatever I do. With two baths at two different temperatures, I can do a refrigerator, I can do a heat pump, I can do a heat engine. So it must be the case they are so dense I can find all kinds of virtual qubits sitting in there. And my two qubits that constitute the machine just couple into the virtual qubits pre-existing in the bath. And then they transfer it to one external system. So all that a heat engine does is looks at the bath. The bath already contains a particular temperature. All that I want is to select that particular temperature and map it on an external system. And this maps my next slide to the end. Thank you.
So this was an absolutely great talk. Let's go back to biology.
Okay. Oh, by the way, I actually solved one way of doing the refrigerator, but probably this was not your question. So tell me what the question is.
Well, this is okay. Consider that we start with one bacteria on a petri dish,
yes,
surrounded by food, surrounded by sugars.
Correct.
Okay. We come back a day later, and there's a whole population, there's less sugar, and there's a whole population of bacteria.
Indeed.
So population inversion has taken place, that is, the population of large molecules like proteins,
yes,
and so forth, is inverted compared to e to the minus kt, the temperature. Okay. So. A culture of bacteria growing performs what you would call work. It performs population inversion. So my question is the cell a heat engine?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, of course, the word is population, but I'm not sure that these bacteria are, although they are more complex, I'm not sure that their energy level is higher. So whether or not it produced work in this sense, I'm not sure. It's a very interesting question. I will have to think about
it. I think it is true. They have certainly stored a lot of energy in molecular bonds
The
creation of the large molecules.
No, actually, when you create a bond, you lower the energy. Every time when you make a bond, you lower it. But look, obviously, any biological process that where there are changes, not that a piece of bone is just conserved as a fossil, is an open-driven system. So you pump free energy into it, and then it does all kinds of things. When you stop pumping free energy, the thing just stops evolving. So indeed, biological systems are, per definition, they are thermal engines. That is no doubt about that. Incidentally, this is something that you have to realize. We don't eat in order to get energy. We eat in order to get free energy. Okay? So in principle, you could imagine a biological system that functions by eating ice cubes. You know, if it is in Spain, it's very easy. Or outside, and it functions. Well, we are used to get free energy from the nutrients that you said there. But that is the whole idea of pumping this thing in. I don't know how to be more specific of that. Whether the end product is energetically more favorable or less, that I believe depends very much on the particular biology. That is, in general, many molecules, by forming bonds, the energy is lower, but some of them just live on metastable states, where, in fact, you have to store more energy to form the bond. I don't know what our action in biology is. Still waiting till my daughter finishes. Yes.
So perhaps since we're in this whole room, we should reinstate the tradition of asking if Sci students or students in general have questions. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when you redefined the thing as a virtual cube and said that, like, yes, your fridge in the kitchen isn't really a refrigerator.
Yes, it's not a genuine one.
Is this new genuine refrigerator not a bit like putting the ice cube in contact with it?
Well, yes, it is. That is exactly what any refrigerator does, but it's an ice cube. It's a virtual ice cube. So what you have, here's the big image about what actually thermodynamics is. If you have just one single bath at temperature, say, 10 degrees, okay, contains no ice cubes. All it contains 10 degrees Celsius. Now you have two baths, one at 10, one at 50 degrees. If you look at a 50 degrees Celsius, contains only 50 degrees Celsius. Now you look at the combined system. The combined system virtually contains 0 degrees Celsius in the combined energy levels. And that is, to my view, the correct way of looking at what thermodynamics is. There is hidden, and that's why having two thermal baths enables you to do things that you cannot do if you have only one. It contains a virtual ice cube. And the engine, by coupling, putting its hands in both things, takes that virtual thing and plugs it into your system. Yeah, you got it perfectly. That's exactly what it is.
Very more questions from the students? Okay,
so there's a constraint that E1, E2, and E3 have to satisfy.
E1, yes.
How sensitive is the working of your machine to that constraint?
Okay. Right. So I wanted here to have things, especially for the refrigerator, to come quite clean. And if I put the interaction between my qubits and everything strong, then they will not achieve a Boltzmannian that is governed by the free Hamiltonian of the object, but you have to renormalize it, taking into account the interaction. So that's why I looked at weak couplings, and weak couplings only work regularly. The moment you increase the coupling, then you are off resonance, and then there are all the standard quantum ways in which you have, you know, the enlargement of the energy level. So it depends on how strong you couple.
Questions?
So the way you presented everything is key to the production of these virtual qubits. So that seems like an interesting way of thinking about. Leads to some new insights. But there's an older way which seems to get lost there. I'm just wondering what the relation between the two concepts is. The older is in terms of cycles. So if you look in the detail of how this refrigerator or heat pump or whatever functions, it's always by going through some cyclical process.
Yes.
Sort of a violation of material balance, if you will. So I'm just wondering how that fits together with the idea of virtual qubits.
It doesn't need to be a cycle. You can extract, well, you can It is a cycle whenever you want to bring your system back to the initial state. So then you are not afraid that something occurred. You, instead of taking things from the bath, you take things from the machine itself. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when I drop an ice cube here and it melts, I don't care about that. So then it doesn't need to be a cycle. So it depends exactly on what I would like to do. I deplete. I don't see a big change in the bath because they are so big that even if I borrow an ice cube from there, nothing happens. It doesn't really need to be cycling.
Are you sure? I think that's some reason why you need two qubits instead of just one.
So that you can get,
if you just had one, all it could do is go back and forth.
If it is one, it can only go back and forth. Yes, I need, look, the point is that, well, I want it to separate. I want it to have one piece of equipment that gets in contact with one thermal bath, one that goes in contact with the other.
Right.
And that's why I needed two qubits. In fact, I can make an, you know, I was cheating here. This is not the smallest. You can do an even smaller one. All you need to have two transitions that come here and there. So in principle, I can do with a three-level system instead of my two qubits. If this three-level system has some geometry, so that this transition essentially is in contact with one thermal bath and this transition is in contact with another.
But then won't you find that you have a...
Then you have a favorable, then you have a favorite
direction,
yes,
between.
Well, the cycle, okay, let me put it. The cycle comes in because you don't want to change the structure of this thing. So you do have a cycle in there. But actually what it does, it just by this cycle I succeed to suck that virtual ice cube from the bath and throw it out. So this is, if you want, a pump that goes like a cycle and takes ice cubes from the two baths and throws them out.
Mm-hmm.
That is all it does. And if you really go, to what you said, there is one more important thing. During this cycle, as I started at the beginning, I need a constraint. The constraint that the cycle doesn't move backwards and only move forwards. That constraint is, in fact, the one that is responsible of achieving this key virtual. We are populating and depopulating levels. So whenever there is a constraint, I can achieve this. If there is no constraint, I cannot. But that is a more complicated thing to look at. Those are the nitty-gritties of how actually this one works.
Maybe one last question.
Have you actually tried convincing someone to build this sort of refrigerator in China?
Oh, I'm not good at convincing anybody of anything. No, just ask my wife. No, but there were people who just offered themselves. Yes. Look, these ones are simple systems. So in principle, people doing ion traps can control. And there were a number of groups that showed interest in doing it. So let's go. The other thing that I would like to mention, and coming back to your question about the strength of interaction, here I had a precise interaction Hamiltonian. And you would imagine that it's difficult to engineer something like that. In fact, it doesn't matter, because if the coupling is weak enough, only the resonance transitions work. So plug any Hamiltonian, any interaction, and it will do the work. That is one of the amazing things.
I have one question.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back to Lee's point.
Yes.
In biological systems, so what you've done is by assuming two heat baths at different temperature, you've enabled yourself to generate these non-equilibrium processes. But is that the way biological systems work?
No.
So what I'm looking for is some analogy between the way biological systems drive processes with these two heat baths at different temperatures? What is the analogy? Is there any?
No, I don't think so. Because I just, that was just a motivation. But there could be instances in which in biology it works purely by two things. Mm-hmm. And at larger scale, mm-hmm. that's how it works. You know, you put them in contact with the sun and with the vacuum outside. So,
or could it be that there's this virtual temperature notion is more?
Perhaps it is more because you have some carriers. So biology just goes. You have little batteries that come. You produce ATP and you stick an ATP into another molecule and it gives the current. It is interesting to see, most probably, that is my guess, I can see from the production of ATP that as a virtual qubit, and it's a carrier of this virtual qubit into something else, but that at the moment I don't. But I know how to build a biological refrigerator. Mm-hmm. That works based on ATP. So mm-hmm. in the end, I found out how a molecule can actually pull a part of itself. But
does that happen?
Well, we don't know. And you need to go and convince somebody to make an experiment. Now, biologists are saying, why should we make an experiment? Does that happen? It's like a sort of chicken and egg thing. Prove to us that it happens, and then we'll go to make an experiment. Okay, yes.
Yeah, a natural suggestion, I have no idea if it's true, is that if there was a biological function for refrigeration, that it would happen across cell membranes.
There is. It depends on how much time I have to spend.
More amount of time.
Yeah, here it is. Catalysis. It depends on how much time I have. What's catalysis? You have some molecule that is very difficult to break, say. And suppose that molecule, this is the molecule, and at a certain moment lands on a piece of metal. This is what happened in your car in the catalytic converter. So here you have all kind of stuff which has electrons, and you'll have dipole-dipole interaction or whatever. So you put some tension in the electron cloud of the molecule, and then sometimes, if this gets hit by something else, it may break easier. And that's why, and then these pieces of the molecule fly apart and nothing happens to your metal. So this is the way in which catalysis works. And it enhances rates of reaction, say, 1,000 times or something like that. But it needs to be pretty hot, nevertheless. It's quite hot there. Now, a reason why this catalysis, although it's good, it's not perfectly good, is that, you see, this molecule is more or less like a potato. And you put it on the table, and it just touches it in a few points. You know, it doesn't touch very well. Biology is far more... goes much better. Here is my molecule. And this is an enzyme. An enzyme is a big, big, big beast, a bigger molecule, which has an active site here. And this site has very much the shape of the molecule that comes in, like hand in glove. And now it forms more bonds here, which means it deforms it more. And now the speed up of the reactions is about 40 orders of magnitude. It's just amazing. Just amazing. And it is because it deforms it more. Now, there is a catch with it. If you look at the reaction rate versus temperature, first the reaction rate increases and then it drops. So why does it increase at the beginning? It's because when things are very cold, you know, this molecule goes slowly, slowly, and then when it's hotter, it enters, it goes out. But as you increase the temperature, that active site starts vibrating. So either the molecule then doesn't come, or it's too open, so it loses the ability to have catalysis. And now, if this molecule would be able to cool this part of it, the vibrational degree of freedom, then it can survive. So that will enhance the catalysis. So that is an absolutely clear biological functionality. And that is my argument, that most probably it will be.
So you should look in thermophiles. There are these...
That's why they...
Yes, so...
We are going through big pain of publishing even this idea because all papers said, well, does it happen? No. By the way, there is an easy mechanism for this cooling. And that is the amazing thing. You see, what happens is that you need free energy. So some of these enzymes have another active site here where you stick a battery. That is an ATP molecule that can decompose and do ADP. And phosphate. And when it does that, the molecule, the enzyme, sometimes occurs a conformational change. It really changes shape. It's quite amazing. There are big changes possible there. Now, the interesting thing is, if all I do here is to close it and then reopen it slowly, I cool it down. That's all you need. And here's a way of seeing it. Suppose do it quantum. You have a harmonic oscillator at some temperature. These are populated. I close it no matter how. That simply means that now between these two sides, it's sort of bigger repulsion. I'm looking only at a relative degree of freedom. So it is a deeper potential well. And suppose it stays there till it re-thermalizes. When it does that, of course, it warms up. But it stays there till it re-thermalizes. And then, because the distance between the energy level is bigger, you will have more on the ground state than here, at the same temperature. And now suppose you open it adiabatically slowly, so you will remain in the ground state. It's cooler. All you need is to clamp it down and reopen. Something that some biological molecules are known to do, but well, it's a question, then it gets re-thermalized, it's a question of time scales. No. It's a complicated thing, one should investigate. But it is exactly what you were saying. If it has a clean and clear biological function, then there is a chance that it will do. So here is an example that can do that.
Well, so Sunday's around for...
Till Saturday.
Okay, so a few more days. And we'll be back frequently, we hope.
Yes.
So let's thank Sandy once again.